Welcome to UMES 30. I'm Brian Daniels. UMES 30 is a half-hour talk show featuring conversations with guests from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, the local community, and from around the nation. We cover a wide variety of topics that are of interest to you. George Floyd. That name is ringing across this country and around the world. George Floyd died while in police custody in May of 2020. A Minneapolis police officer was captured on video kneeling on the neck of George Floyd for almost 9 minutes while he was on the ground with his hands cuffed behind him. On the video, George could be heard saying that he could not breathe. Protests erupted in this country and across the globe. Why was this case of police brutality different from those perpetrated in the past? Can racial justice ever be achieved? Dr. H.J. Harris has written a book called Solving the Race Issue in America. Dr. Harris joins us by phone from North Carolina to give his thoughts on the current racial climate and how it might be possible to make lasting change. Dr. Harris, welcome to UMES 30. It is a pleasure to have you on the program today.
My pleasure. I've been looking forward to this.
Okay, well, Dr. Harris, let me just start by asking about your background. You are a retired attorney, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And could you tell me what your experience was like going through the process of becoming an attorney? What, as a matter of fact, what inspired you to become an attorney? What was that like for you?
Well, my uncle was an attorney, and you know, I got a chance as a little boy to work in his law office. He represented people like Sidney Poitier, Della Reese, Chamberlain, and he was an attorney in Harlem. And man, that just seemed like the most incredible thing to me. So that got me the bug.
Where did you get your degree?
I graduated from Columbia University in New York. I came to Columbia in 1960. Mm-hmm. I was a part of a group in the early, I guess, in the late 50s. Some of the Ivy League schools were looking for, you might say, bright kids from the South. And I had come up to a segregated school system. And my aunt was a school teacher and my mother, and they felt that I needed to get more education. So I actually went to school in the summer after my 10th grade year at the Rhodes Prep School in New York City. And there I got was affiliated with Columbia Teachers College, and they were doing a series of IQ tests, and they were using us to test the test. I got a great score, mm-hmm. and Columbia offered me a scholarship to come after my junior year, and I graduated from there and went on to eventually become a lawyer and do other things.
And can you talk about some of your experiences as being a lawyer, especially when it comes to dealing with the racial disparities in the justice system?
Well, you know, you begin to see things when you're in the legal system, especially, and you go into the courtroom and you begin to feel a difference. I remember I represented white and black clients. Mm-hmm. At one point, many of my clients were actually other lawyers who didn't like to try cases. And sometimes when I'd be representing, let's just say, a white defendant, the judge, I often got a sense that the system wanted to give him a chance. You know, I'd bring a young man in who'd been in trouble and whatnot, and it seemed to be much easier to say, you know, let's get this guy. He seems like a good kid. He's hanging out with the wrong bunch. But when the same thing, basically same type of situation with a black child, I got a feeling that the judge wanted to teach him a lesson. And so from an overall point of view, just looking at the system, you could often see the difference between not so much give them a break, but, you know, let's show them, give them an opportunity to let's teach them a lesson. Yeah.
So I was just going to say that, you know, yeah, so we have one group of people where we basically embrace the spirit of the law as opposed to the letter of the law.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. And so, you know, also in the justice system, you begin to see that money talks, that, you know, so many of the, well, in New York, they used to call them, I think, 18B lawyers, the, you know, the legal aid lawyers. And not that they were not good lawyers, but often they were so overwhelmed with so many cases. You know, you can only do so much, and you got a certain amount each hour.
Okay.
And so it was really not a lawyer's fault, per se, but the system, this is how it was set up. If you didn't have a lawyer, they often say, if you don't have a lawyer, they'll appoint one for you.
Mm-hmm.
And the lawyers they appointed were often good lawyers, but when you got 50 or 60 cases, it's hard to do a good job at the hourly rate that they're giving you. So you really learn that it's really about, you got to have money in the system. You got to have some money. And so when you see the disparity between, when you can bring in a legal team with all your research, et cetera, you're treated differently. The jury sees you differently. I think they get a sense that, man, this guy's really innocent. And he's doing everything to prove his innocence, et cetera. So it makes a difference. If you have money, the system works a whole lot better than if you don't have money.
I see. So let me go back to 2005. We'll talk about Hurricane Katrina real quick. And, you know, one of the things that's noteworthy about that particular storm, as it especially went through the Gulf Coast and through New Orleans, Louisiana, that it pretty much laid bare all the racial tension that was kind of bubbling beneath the surface, especially the people affected in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans. And I specifically remember there was a particular shooting that occurred over the Danziger Bridge in, I think it's like East New Orleans, where people were trying to escape from the destruction.
Yes.
And that culminated in two people, I believe, being killed while trying to cross the bridge. And these were people who were killed by the New Orleans Police Department.
New Orleans showed that. I think one of the things that I remember, I was working with some young kids, and a young fellow said to me, he said, "Mr. Harris, I can't understand how they can get the TV people in there, and they're taking pictures, and yet they can't get in food and medical supplies." And I remember there was a shot of a person, a dead person in a wheelchair right outside the stadium there.
Hmm.
He said, "I don't understand that." And, you know, I had to stop for a minute. Sometimes the children can really show us a side of us. That I wrote a poem once, and it says, "Listen to the children. Children seldom lie. Let them show your soul to you. Let them make you cry." And that just blew me away when he said that. I'm like, that's how you can get in there to take pictures. Literally.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, covered a nice news story, but yet there's all this suffering going on. And as I recall about the bridge incident, I think it seemed that there was like New Orleans, like many places in the South, are very racially segregated.
Mm-hmm.
But, if you look around, one of the great doctors said the other day, he said healthcare, I think a doctor from Harvard, he said that healthcare in America is more impacted by your zip code than by your DNA.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that, certainly.
Yeah. And so it seems that they were trying to leave and go into another area, and the police didn't want them to do that, I guess maybe for fear of looting, et cetera. But, you know, it's once again, it's a mindset.
And so the reason I bring up Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana, because I'm going to fast forward to, you know, now 15 years later in 2020, we've got the COVID-19 thing happening, everybody on lockdown. And I kind of see echoes of that to a different degree happening now. So you've got everybody in lockdown. There's a lot of frustration and tension going on. There are disparities in the rate at which people are contracting the disease. You know, overwhelmingly Black and brown people are contracting the disease disproportionately to the rest of the population. And, you know, treatment also is a little bit scarce in the Black community. And then we've got the police killings that have been happening this year, and the latest of which I'm sure you're aware with George Floyd. And I get the feeling that that particular killing has created a turning point. It has, like, pulled the scab off of the racial tension that's here in America. So I really, what I'm looking for is for you to speak to that. And can you tell me basically what's different this time around with the killing of George Floyd than other killings in the past?
Well, you know, Ryan, you've said a whole lot of things there. Let's first, with George Floyd, I took my daughter. I went up to see the body. I went up to the city in North Carolina where they had the body right outside of Federal. I took my daughter up because I wanted to see a part of history. I've always wanted to see a part of history. And I tell you, he looked so regal, and the way they had him sitting there in the casket, very regal. It was hard to imagine that the things that had happened to him had happened to him. So that's like the end result. The startup with the virus, the healthcare in the black community, you know, there's a, and I, you know, we talk politics, but right now I think the political spectrum is so distinct and so separated that, for example, in North Carolina, you have a Republican-dominated legislature, and they've been turning down Medicaid money. They don't want to expand Medicaid. And so many of your people in the black community don't have proper health care. And really, not because of lack of funds, but lack of, for some reason, this philosophy that they don't want to expand health care. And in some instances, maybe it's just because President Obama did it, because you get that sense that whatever Obama did, they're against, even if they were for it before, they're against it now. And so without the availability of health care, working in, spent time working in some of the public housing units, and so people don't have a doctor. In other words, I was listening to the president. They were talking, he said, well, if you need a test, call your doctor. But many of the people don't have a doctor.
Right.
And so the emergency room was pretty much their doctor, and they didn't go there until it was an emergency.
Right.
That sets you up so that whatever comes through, whatever illness, whatever it is, by the time you go to get help, it's often too late.
Right. And I can tell you anecdotally that I, you know, personally, I know of a couple of people, unfortunately, who have passed away from the COVID-19 virus. And in one particular case, this particular individual had become ill, had gone to the hospital, and they did not test him for coronavirus. And they basically just sent him home. And he later, you know, passed away. And it was found out that later that he had indeed contracted coronavirus. I've heard stories about this like over and over and over again where, you know, especially, you know, if you are a part of the minority population, you go to a hospital and, you know, they don't test you.
Absolutely. I mean, I had a personal experience back in March. I think I had it. I had a temperature of 101.8. I had chills. I mean, I was sick. So we called the hospital. First, I called the hospital. Someone to check. The emergency, you call them, you get a recording. And then we knew administrators at the hospital. Sandra is my wife. She's a former state representative from the House of Representatives of the state. So she knew who to call. They couldn't get a test, referred me to my doctor. My doctor couldn't get me a test, and I never did get a test. Okay, I mean, she went all the way up to the governor's office.
Wow.
And so it's just not available. And I mean, I'm like, hey, money is no object. We'll pay for it. So structurally, it just was not there. So you figure the racial issue, a whole lot of people don't get the testing. Even if you had a doctor, et cetera, still the infrastructure was just not there. I tried to get tests. My daughter came from New York to live with me. Now, I thought that was a slam dunk. You're coming from New York. That's a hot spot. Let me get. I put her into quarantine. I said, well, after 7 days in quarantine, I'll get her a test. Ryan, I have not been able to get her a test yet.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
14 days. And even my own doctor, you know, he said, well, you know, we're not taking any new patients. I said, well, this is my daughter. So they never did, you know, like I'm you know, having concerns. But he said they've only been allotted a certain amount of the testing. And so they have really been reserving it just for their patients.
In case our listeners are just joining in, I'm speaking with Dr. H.J. Harris. He's written a book called Solving the Race Issue in America. This is UMES 30. I'm Brian Daniels. So speaking of your book, let's go ahead and jump right into this, Solving the Race Issue in America. Now, the overall arch of your book, you're saying that a lot of the things that we have done here in America, both black and white, to try and solve the race issue has not quite worked. And you're looking at this from a more spiritual perspective. Could you kind of help break that down for us a little bit?
Absolutely. One of the things, there are 3 points we like to make in the book. First, whatever you approach, you have to know what you're dealing with. And so it's important to know the history. So many, just today, I was asked to comment on the NFL now saying that, you know, now they understand about the healing. Okay. And my question, well, Kaepernick lost 3 years of his life. He made a grievance against them, so they came to some type of settlement. But he's lost 3 years of his life during his prime. Mm-hmm. And I was sharing with him, I said, that's the way it has worked from Jack Johnson. And Jack Johnson, they wouldn't give him a championship. He had to literally go out of the country to Australia. Mm. They would not let him give him a heavyweight championship. And when he finally did get one, there were literally riots because when he won the fight, then he eventually had to leave the country because he married a white woman. He left the country. So it happened with Muhammad Ali.
Right.
And this is something you can't get back. You know, as an athlete, you have your prime years.
Mm-hmm.
But when they take that away, it just does not come back. So the tenor of the book is to know the past, just to know it, because if you know the past, it can give you, set you up for the next part, which is to say, now we know what does not work. You can't approach resolving the race issue from the things that have not worked in the past. And from the laws, the courts, you know, 1954, the Supreme Court decision, the desegregation decision. Well, it's the same Supreme Court, different people, but the same body that said Plessy versus Ferguson, which created segregation.
Right.
In 1896, you see. So when you look at it from that angle, the politics hasn't happened. You know, one party, there's this this desire for power, which really leaves people, the common system, citizen out of the equation. And so the spiritual approach is, number one, that we're a God-fearing people, so to recognize there's a God. But the second principle is, it says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Mm.
And so if we operate simply from that vibration, we would have none of this. So automatically, most of the country is in violation of the second commandment.
Mm. Indeed. But would you agree that over the decades and centuries, you know, some of the movements that have pushed for equal rights in America, you know, you have to agree that there is some measure of success in these, but we just kind of have to build upon that.
There is absolutely success. There's great measures of success. But you know something, Brian?
Mm-hmm.
When people do something against their will, there's a saying, when you change your mind against your will, you're of the same opinion still. That the structural progress, for example, after Lyndon Johnson continued Kennedy's work with the Great Society, if you notice, most of that legislation was put in with some type of sunset clause in the Civil Rights Act. And the idea being that it's not that it's right or wrong, but right now we can't stop it, so let's take another crack at it 20 years down the road or 25 years down the road.
Mm.
And the real height of, you might say, the black community's benefits from the civil rights era kind of terminated in the late 70s, the early 80s.
Mm.
And it's been pretty much a downhill vibration from there. So we have had great advances. But if you notice now, the tone is changing so that those advances are being eroded. You look at the public school system. With integration, we had there was a point in the late 70s, early 80s, where you had more black men in colleges, and, I mean, people were getting degrees. And you look at the proof of that, some of the top guys, the fellow who was head of Merrill Lynch, mm-hmm. the fellow who was at Time Warner, black men, American Express, who came through that era, got to the top and did great things. Okay, but now, you see, once they leave, it's a whole another ball game at the top. So these advances have been eroded because the spiritual dilemma has never been resolved. And so that's why when we talk about why is this different, that many of my friends, we talk, and I said to my white friends, I said, now that they've seen it, what is it? They had to see it in real time, okay? I mean, it's the first time I've ever really seen somebody virtually die in real time mm-hmm. in a murder. Like, my father passed. I sat there. I watched him take his last breath. We've been through that. That mm-hmm. seems to be a part of the natural order of things. But to see somebody literally kill a person in front of your very eyes. And so when people saw that, it struck a chord. And the question I had for folks was, when we told you this for the last 25 times, did you think I was lying? Why did you have to see this to now have this reaction? Suppose that young lady had not taken the video. We wouldn't even be here now, the man.
Exactly, exactly.
People would be making allegations, but we would not be here. So that's a spiritual problem. When you have to see it like that, I was looking at, I had posted something on Facebook, and I saw a guy. Mm-hmm. A guy responded. He was looking at the picture, the video of the three men on top of the guy. The one fellow with his knee on his neck, and the other mm-hmm. holding him down.
Right.
And he said, and his comment was, "I'd like to know what was happening before that."
Yeah, and you know, we see that so often. You know, and even now with George Floyd's death. You know, I mean, just the nakedness of this particular video, the rawness of it, the fact that you mentioned, you know, it happened basically, we're watching a man die in real time, and we still have people who are skeptics. We have people who are very cynical. How can we deal with that? How is it even possible to deal with that, you know, with people who have such strong opinions in the opposite direction, and they're unwilling to change?
Well, that's the thing, and that's why I say the spiritual. In the Bible, there's a, to paraphrase a lot, there's a statement that says there's three processes. You have to acknowledge it, you have to ask forgiveness, and you have to make atonement. And that's the process of, you might say, spiritual transformation.
Mm-hmm.
When there's a portion in the Bible and it says, when man comes before the judging father and he says, you know, you didn't feed me when I was hungry. You didn't clothe me when I was naked. You didn't come to me when I was in prison. And the person says, but God, you know, when did I do this? When did I not feed you? When did I not clothe you? When did I not come to visit you in prison? And he said, when you did it to the least of them, you did it to me.
Mm.
And so that's a spiritual dilemma there, because all the things that have been done to black people was like, let's just say, doing it to the least of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you get around that? You got to first acknowledge it. You say, hey, man, maybe I wasn't there. I mean, I've been in these study groups where, you know, one of the perpetrators of some serious, you know, hatred 100 years ago, and the person today said, well, that was my grandfather, my great-grandfather, and If he thought it was right at the time, why should I second guess him and ask forgiveness?
Mm.
And I said, well, at the time he did it, it was wrong.
Right.
It wasn't like
right.
It was okay to kill people then. Mm-hmm. It was wrong then.
Yeah, so, exactly. So but in the little bit of time that we have left, I want to address something in terms of people who are so entrenched in let's just say in the majority culture, the mainstream culture, you know, people who choose to turn a blind eye to this sort of thing and they don't want to see. So do you think that there's actually any hope in redeeming these people, or maybe is it up to maybe the next generation to take care of that?
I think that a lot of people are going to be transformed. I think that this movement, that those that let's just call the negative forces, the negative forces are stunned. I'm shocked at seeing this swell around the world. The negative forces are stunned. And I think that a part of the, you might say, evolution of culture and of society is that when two or more gathered on one accord, I am the creative force, the change force among them. But when you have 2 million, 200 million, those are the kind of vibrations that can literally change the world. And so I like to think of those people, the negative people, as being, if life was an orchestra, they're in the orchestra, but they're playing out of tune. The instrument is out of tune. But if the orchestra can play that song now, make that symphony long enough and strong enough, sooner or later they'll find the right note. Some will. There's some that won't, but some will. And as we're saying in the Bible, it says that the children will lead us. And very often, I know in the civil rights era of the 60s, that the children led them. I saw old racist parents who, when the kids were hanging, they were like, the kids brought them across the line. Mm-hmm. They said, well, you know, you guys are not so bad. And I'm like, well, you're not so bad either. Okay. So the youth will lead us, and I believe that this transformation is underway, and the negative forces cannot stop it. It's bigger than all of us. It will transform America. And there are only two choices. And the Bible says, choose this day whom you will serve. We will either rise up and meet this challenge and become the city on the hill, or the cancer will eat and destroy the nation. And over a period of time, it will go back into the sand like some of the other cultures that didn't get it.
Oh, wow. So how can people get a hold of your new book?
Well, our website, www.solvingtheraceissue.com. And then we're, of course, on Amazon. We have the Kindle book, the paperback. So go straight to Amazon and get it. And a lot of people get it through our Facebook page, facebook.com/solvingtheraceissueinamerica. So Amazon is probably the best place to get it, but on our book, on our Facebook page, you can get it, and it comes to me eventually, and I autograph it.
Okay. I've been speaking with Dr. H.J. Harris. He's written a book called Solving the Race Issue in America. And Dr. Harris, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you for showing up and having this conversation with me here on UMES 30. Thank you so much.
My honor, Brian, and you keep up the good work, and all the listeners, let's just plug in. Hope is on the way. We can do this.
Listen to this or any past episode of UMES 30 by logging on to WESM913.org or through the NPR One app available for download on Google Play. UMES 30 is produced in the studios of 91.3 WESM, located on the campus of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. The views and opinions expressed on UMES 30 are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore.